Welcome to episode 67 of the Department of Metal Antiquities, and I thank you for tuning in. We are the podcast that tells you or informs you about albums by your favorite artists you might not even know existed. This week we are talking about Whitford St. Holmes, which is a record, a collaboration record between Brad Whitford at the time, late of Aerosmith, and Derek St. Holmes, at the time, late of the Ted Nugent Band. If you are checking us out because of either of those two groups, hopefully you are willing to give us a 2-week trial, see if what we're doing here is up your street and all that kind of great stuff. But just give me a second so I can tell you about a couple of my friends. Darren from Saskatchewan, has a podcast about hockey fighting and all that kind of great stuff. The enforcers, the people that live the role, and sometimes even fans. I've been on there. I've actually been on his show a couple of times, and I'm still apologizing to him for that. And Alec from Five for Fighting out of Florida, similar podcast, a great thing. I'm a big fan of hockey and old-time hockey, so I definitely check those dudes out on a weekly basis, and I think everybody should, really. But you are here to talk about music and to hear about music, and definitely some aggression in the kinds of things we do. But there's really not a whole lot to get to about this particular setup. So with that, we cue the music. And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities,
where we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
As always, it is Nick Cameron of Glacially Musical, joined by my good friend, co-host, and musical man about the Sudetenland. That's not good. Duncan Evans, how are we doing?
I'm doing okay. I don't know what the Sudetenland even is.
But you know what? I realized after I said it, that is not something that even should be discussed. It was part of World War II. Part of the appeasement process, and we're going to move on.
Okay, fair enough. Well, how are you doing? And who are we listening to? I'm kind of cheating here because I actually know who we're listening to because you showed me the record cover.
Oh, Duncan breaks fourth walls like the Kool-Aid Man.
But I actually can't quite remember. It was a band that were called like Dejuna or something.
Yeah,
but
that's cool. The name of the band is Dejunah. And I don't know if that's Dejunah. I don't know. They're a Chicagoland punk noise band, and they are awesome. I had the awesome chance to review this album as a vinyl review a number of years ago. And I'll be honest, I didn't do it justice. And it's a hard kind of music, and I did not spend enough time really digging into this record. I listened to it today while between listening to today's subject and getting, I actually had a bunch of records to clean. I got another album from Forever Autumn. My copy of Reload showed up, so I now have all the Metallica records that I'm going to own.
Nice.
Until they release a new one. And so I had to do some Patreon album that I purchased last year showed up. Officially the longest pre-order I've ever had. It was over a year because of vinyl delays.
makes sense, I guess.
So I was listening to this one because I decided I was going to put this one on. Actually, I'm going to make a list of the things I'm going to start doing so that way I do better. But anyway, what are we talking about today?
Okay, so we are talking about Whitford St. Holmes.
Who are these people?
Well, exactly. So this is a collaboration between Brad Whitford from Aerosmith and is it Derek St. Holmes? Yes, it's Derek St. Holmes, who played with Ted Nugent. So these two people collaborated in 1981 and released a record just simply called Whitford St. Holmes. And basically, in spite of the fact that they were both from huge bands and were played with huge artists, this kind of just flopped. Nobody really seemed to buy it, and they did a tour and played like really small, tiny club venues. You're going
to
say so.
Well, to begin with, I think the reason why it flopped is because we're talking about, and I mean this lovingly, 2 second bananas here.
This is true. Aerosmith. Who knows? Like Brad Whitford, if you said that name, how many people actually know that name? Derek St. Holmes, even fewer people know that name. Correct. Say Aerosmith, everyone knows. Say Ted Nugent, a lot of people know.
Well, everyone has heard these men. There is no one in my house that has not heard them playing, not counting this record, because I'm the only person in this house that's heard that record. But they did a tour of the southeastern United States, which I guess Ted Nugent was pretty big back in those days. And, well, probably still big down there, honestly. And they were playing like tiny venues. And I could find no information on that tour.
Wow.
And then they went in and recorded the record and did another tour. They toured with BOC and somebody else as well, playing like legitimate venues, playing arenas. They played like the Spectrum in Philadelphia, where the Flyers played, you know, that kind of stuff. But I could find no information on what they played on that tour.
There you go. Yeah. So this was really a small thing, and I think a pretty short-lived thing. They seem to split up pretty soon after that. Let's look here. Yeah, basically, Whitford reunited with Joe Perry, with the Joe Perry Project, and then they both returned to Aerosmith a couple of years later, and St. Holmes worked with Nugent again sporadically in the following years, it says here on Wikipedia.
Right, this album comes out in August of 81, and in 1980, in less than 2 years, yeah. Brad Whitford is now playing in the Joe Perry Project, and less than two, I think a year after that, they were in talks to rejoin Aerosmith.
Exactly. It
came and went, but the interesting thing is it came back around again.
Exactly. In 2015.
Right. So the reunion that I don't think anybody asked for was Whitford St. Holmes. This is not speaking to the music. I'm just speaking to the fact that the Department of Metal Antiquities is a podcast. As I say in the intro every week, we are the podcast that tells you about music by your favorite musicians you've probably never heard of.
Exactly.
And that's what this is. I don't know anyone who has heard this record. I don't know anyone who had heard of it. This is only on our list because I discovered it browsing through Discogs.
Well, I think, weren't we looking at Tom Allen? Because Tom Allen was the producer of this record, and he also produced several Judas Priest records, and I think he produced, and Def Leppard, that's right. So
I apologize, I got the story.
I think we even mentioned this on a podcast. I think the moment that you discovered this album is actually recorded for posterity on a previous podcast episode.
It was the Def Leppard podcast, Def Leppard's On Through the Night. All of a sudden you and I were both checking our sources while we were recording, and we both went down different YouTube rabbit holes, and I found this, and I went, wait a minute, what is this?
Yep.
And, you know, as we tend to do, we just discuss it as it comes up. So, yes, we accidentally discovered this completely by accident. We were walking down the street and we kicked over a can and there was a dollar. So, or in England, a pound.
Exactly. A quid.
Or a euro. I mean, do you guys still have euros, or did you get rid of
it? No, we have pounds. It was a long... Oh, we don't even want to get into that. Basically, the UK has now left the European Union. But even when we were in the European Union, nobody wanted to actually start using euros. There was a big debate about this, and everyone was like, no, we're British. We want to keep our pounds because that's what makes us British and, all this. So, you know, it's
one of those. You got to love stubbornness over a construct based on nothing.
I know.
Anyway.
But that's where we're at. So yeah, we still have pounds.
So going back, circling us back after I've knocked us completely off track, I apologize. That not only during their reunion, I could find some information, and I was able to pull up a set list for Whitford St. Holmes on the reunion tour. They also did a second record.
called Reunion, yeah, which was sold on the tour and was officially released the next year in 2016. And it has a bonus disc, and that bonus disc is this record that we're listening to now. Because I guess they figured that so few people bought the first one that they were probably getting more popularity the second time around. So they thought, let's just put the first one as a bonus disc so people can hear it.
Even on the reunion tour, there's not much information regarding the set list.
Sure.
So here's the set list from, and this is what I wanted to talk about. They played the 2016 edition of the Kiss Cruise.
Okay, right.
On the Kiss Cruise, they always have Kiss, obviously. I think four Kiss shows during the cruise, and then they bring in like Kiss related people like Bruce Kulick has brought a band. Bob Kulick has been there, God rest him. And let's see who else. Ace Frehley's been there once. Then they always bring in some other bands. And apparently Whitford St. Holmes was ready to go. So they did Shapes, Rock All Day, Catch My Fall, Tender Is the Night, Hell Is on Fire, Last Child, Hey Baby, Train Kept Rolling, Sharpshooter, which is on this one, Whiskey Woman, which is on this one, Shake It, Gotta Keep on Moving, I think was on this one as well.
No.
Shy Away on this one, Good Time Baby, and Stranglehold. So
only two tracks from this album, I think.
Yeah, and I don't know the Ted Nugent catalog well enough to know how much
I don't.
Ted Nugent stuff. I guess, well, that's the only one it lists as a Ted Nugent cover, but it doesn't list any of them as Aerosmith covers, which we do know Last Child, Hey Baby, and Train Captain Roland, that's Aerosmith.
Yeah.
So I guess they played tracks off the newest record too, which I really couldn't find a whole lot of information on that either. Mm, so not no. only was this band forgotten, not only was this album forgotten, the whole thing is just wiped from history. Nobody recorded it for posterity because just nobody cared.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it was released on Columbia as well. So it's, you know, produced by Tom Allen. So this could have been, this was intended to be kind of a big deal, but it just did not work out that way.
I've noticed one thing is that when people leave large bands to go solo, the same record label tends to sign them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peter Criss left Casablanca record, or left Kiss on Casablanca, Casablanca put out his record. When, you know, I think Dio was on the same label in the States as they were on Sabbath, you know, stuff like that. Yeah.
I think there's something about the name Whitford St. Holmes that just sounds terrible. Bad band name.
It sounds like Spinal Tap.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that's the like only reason that they didn't do well, but yeah, it doesn't sound great. It sounds like a small, really nice village in the south of England that you'd go and visit, and there'd be like a church and a really nice town square, and nothing ever happened, and life's really slow. It's like the opposite of hard rock, you know, fast cars and exciting stuff. It feels like the absolute opposite of that. So
for me, it sounds like the name of an 1880s United States robber baron who,
right.
Whitford St. Holmes is here to see you, Mom. In New England, not in which is the northeastern United States,
yeah.
Where he would be there to bring his calling card. And his straw cap, he would only be wearing his straw cap in season because you don't wear them out of season. Then you have the straw hat riots like they did in New York. And you know about that one? This is like one of the greatest things I've ever heard. Apparently you're only supposed to wear during the time. You're only supposed to wear straw hats for certain months of the year during the hottest months. And if you wore them after that day, the last day, hooligans were legally allowed to knock them off your head and destroy them.
Wow, okay. So they had some fun with that.
And apparently somebody went too far.
Okay.
As hooligans often do, punching up at high society. But so, yeah, I mean, that's what Whitford St. Holmes sounds. And again, the farthest thing from hard edge rock music that you could possibly go to.
Indeed. So indeed.
You have Whitford, who, God love him to death. You know, I've got, I wouldn't call myself a massive Aerosmith fan by any stretch, but I do have the entire run of Aerosmith records from their debut up to Pump. So the entire run of Columbia albums on vinyl, including the live bootleg album and the Aerosmith Classics Live 1 and 2, which barely feature Whitford and Perry. But he just always struck me as, and Brad Whitford was there.
Yeah, yeah.
Aerosmith has always been Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. They even had a name, yeah. The Toxic Twins. And
yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Brad Hamilton was there, and Joey Kramer was there. And they're very important parts, but they're, you know, they're the icing on the cake. They're not the flour.
For sure, man.
And then, so then we get into Derek St. Holmes. And
I mean, I hadn't even heard of him. I'll be honest. I don't know Ted Nugent's stuff. I think I have got one record. I've kind of avoided Ted Nugent's stuff because I just can't stand Ted Nugent as a person. I have heard some of his stuff, which I kind of like musically, but it's not my favorite. So those two things combined have just meant I'm not going to go out of my way to listen to loads of Ted Nugent, really. So I didn't even know who Derek St. Holmes was, to be honest.
Frankly, after I heard that Ted Nugent said on stage that we should shoot presidential candidates that he disagreed with, I was pretty much out on the Ted Nugent train, and yeah. I have not listened to him since. Now, I if Roger Waters did that, I'd probably be off the Roger Waters train too. So just to be clear. I do not advocate shooting any presidential candidates or suggesting that we should, or I do not advocate the advocation of shooting presidential U.S. presidential candidates. Anyway, but Ted Nugent has done, I mean, frankly, he's done some great music in the 70s. There is some really good stuff. It's a little problematic. He, of course, is an extraordinarily problematic human being that we only found out how problematic he was much later. But I would have to think around this time, because when you think about 1975, 1978, the idea of a Neanderthal human being shooting a bow on stage, running around in a loincloth and a hat with a hatchet, you know, I think that would play. I think that would play really well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you get to 1981, and we're now in the 80s, pastel, we're on the other side of disco. New wave is going on. And I think we've done probably too many records from this era.
Yeah.
we keep falling on albums from 70s dudes, like right at this time. And
well, this is part of the reason why a lot of them get forgotten, isn't it?
It completely is. And I'm just saying we probably should go down to like 71 or scoot up to 91 or 2001 a little bit.
I know what you mean.
Stay away from 81 a little bit. Yeah. But that's exactly why they get forgotten, because now you've got all these 70s rock dudes that want to keep making that money, keep going on tour, keep making records, but now they're a deer in headlights because they don't know what to do.
Well, they either stay doing their 70s stuff and people go, well, we don't like that, that's the old stuff, or they try and go 80s and people go, yeah, this is ridiculous, you're just pretending to be something that you're not. So they can't really win.
No, you really can't. And the thing about, and one of the thing about things about musical fandom, I think, that nobody really talks about, probably only 25% of the people that buy each album are definitely gonna buy the next one.
I know what you mean. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Because, you know, you look at like Metallica sells 30 million copies of the Black Album.
Mm-hmm.
They had sold like 3 million copies of Justice before that. This is a band on the rise. Well, of course you're not gonna maintain that success, but their next album sells like 5 or 6 million.
Yeah.
And it's that's right there. It's a quarter. You got a quarter of your fan base are fans of you forever rather than fans of you right now.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Yeah.
So
that makes
crossing that divide, that do I contemporize or do I go retro? Do I stay true to myself or do I try to fit in? That makes it even more difficult because So, and then you have Derek St. Holmes, who sang some great songs for Ted Nugent. Has a great voice. I assume plays guitar fairly well. I really can't speak to that. But so then Brad Whitford is known as, though it's not exactly true, he's known as the rhythm guitar player for Aerosmith. Joe Perry, but he played lead on Aerosmith as well. But that's just not what anybody thinks of him as.
Yeah, absolutely. So
you have that, and you've got Ted Nugent's other guy. And I just don't see where these two guys with this terrible band name could remotely make a splash.
Yeah. They didn't. Exactly that. Yeah, man. Okay. Well, that's the background. So what about the music? I'm ready to get into it if you are.
Before we get into that, how did you listen to this? Did you YouTube?
Oh, I had to YouTube it. Yes, I found it. Do you know what? It was quite difficult to find a YouTube version of it. I actually found a version that was hodgepodged together.
Okay.
From vinyl rips, versions of the tracks from the reunion bonus disc, all this. And then for some reason had a Gary Moore track on the end that I just had to not listen to. So it was all a bit strange, but I managed to get the whole thing.
Okay. For the record, I didn't know that. I was just trying to flex. And then, so in Duncan there, his response actually makes my point even stronger. You can't even get a YouTube. There's no, like, some dude in Montana or Saskatchewan or Florida or the Czech Republic or the Russian Federation didn't take their copy of it and rip it to YouTube.
Exactly. Almost
everything is there, but yeah, this isn't.
No, exactly.
I listened to it on vinyl because when I discovered this album existed, I thought, you know what? That is the exact kind of crazy that needs to be on my record shelf. Did not listen to anything. I got it for $5 plus shipping. I think it was $8 total. So not a significant financial outlay. And hilariously enough, it's not even a regular copy. It's a promo copy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I have a radio station promo copy of this record.
Nice.
I assume that there were some copies of it on vinyl that were sold, but I cannot speak to those. So again, even how we listen to it, my vinyl copy shows nobody bought it. Your YouTube version shows that nobody even gives two craps about it.
Yep.
So now I am ready to get into the track by track. Let's start off with side one.
All right. So track one, I Need Love. Do you want to go first?
I'll go first. So we have already started off with, well, what do we say? So apparently they don't know. This title is reminiscent of one of my absolute favorite lyricists in Kiss from his solo record, Ace Frehley. I'm in need of love. So clearly these guys are in need of love. And I got to tell you, personally, I am exceptionally tired of the word love being used as for synonyms. Sorry, just checking to see if my kid's paying attention. Synonyms for genitalia, synonyms for the carnal act. I'm sick of that because it's so overdone. And that's, you know, basically what we're looking at. So it starts off with, oh my God, is this Aerosmith? Did Steven Tyler guest on this track? Because Derek St. Holmes, who's singing and Whitford playing lead, sounds just like 1973 Steven Tyler. It is uncanny. And we've got a strong 70s rock tune. The lyrics are bland, if I'm being kind.
Yes.
It's got a really good energetic guitar solo. It, you know, frankly, it is not a bad start. I probably would have released this as the single, and I don't know what the singles are, so maybe they did.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if there were any. it's pretty good.
Hang on. There was one single, and it was Shy Away.
Oh, okay, right. Okay, well, we'll get on to that. So, yeah, look, pretty good rock and roll riffs. Love the voice. Yeah, I get what you're saying about Steven Tyler. I don't know Aerosmith as well as you do. I don't listen. I've got a few of their records, but I don't listen to them all the time. So I didn't quite get the, oh my God, it's uncanny thing. But yeah, I knew they were going for that Aerosmith type of vibe. But I thought it was great. I thought it did a great job with the vocals. Quite a catchy poppy rock chorus. Nice organ sound in the background. Look, this is absolutely nothing new. It's very standard in so many ways. It's very 70s. This has all been done a million times, but it is pretty good. It's, you know, if there weren't all these other 70s rock albums and tracks that this is borrowing from, then this would be fantastic. If this was the first thing that did this, you'd be like, wow, everyone needs to listen to this.
Yeah, it's... I mean, Aerosmith was always the American response to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the hell Ted Nugent is, but this is basically the American response to the American response to Led Zeppelin. And
yes.
So when you say it's been done, yes. We have heard, there is nothing here we haven't heard before.
Absolutely.
It's not bad. It's a pretty good tune. Not great. Pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah, I totally agree. All right, so Whiskey
better
Woman.
Than the first, I'll say, better than the first track off of the Joe Perry Project second record.
Yes. So Whiskey Woman, track two. So this is more standard bluesy rock and roll slash hard rock with a bit of a southern rock edge just coming in around the edges here. Some nice harmonies in the chorus. It's a good catchy chorus. Great solo again. I'm not sure if it's a different one of the guitar players.
It's always Whitford.
Always Whitford, right. But it's more melodic. I like it. I like that variation in the style. This is very, very 70s still. It doesn't feel like 1981. But yeah, look, it's a very similar analysis to that first track. It's pretty decent. It's nothing new. It's nothing absolutely special, but it's solid.
This one for me, again, we're still in that Steven Tyler mode. I mention that because that's a foreshadowing. He's not always in the Steven Tyler vocal range. One of the things that we see is both of the principals on this record really turn in solid to amazing and sometimes outstanding performances. And yeah. Except for songwriting wise.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
They play these songs like they're the most important songs in the world, most definitely.
Absolutely.
However, they're not. And
who wrote the? Is it all? Are they all co-written by the two of them? I can't find that information. You probably have it on your vinyl record.
Look, I didn't even look. Tell you the truth, I just assumed that they co-wrote everything. And
I'm assuming that as well. But I'm just looking here. There's nothing on Wikipedia about that.
No, there's absolutely nothing. If you want me to check, I can go grab it.
Oh, don't worry.
Because right. It's about 4 feet away, and I really don't feel like doing that. So that works out for me. on so this good. One, yes, there is definitely some Southern rock going on. I wrote it as boogie, because the boogie is Southern blues, Southern rock, and the vocals, again, are the exact same as it was before. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to this song, and they're singing about a true whiskey woman, and reminds me a little bit of John Lee Hooker's famous song that he did with Canned Heat, Whiskey and Women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, okay, well, then it's not really going anywhere. And this song never goes anywhere. So we have I Need Love, which is decent, reasonable. Okay. Whiskey Woman, which is just kind of, you probably could have buried this in track four, track three on side one, but they didn't. So, I mean, right now I'm kind of wondering, because I've listened to this before. It showed up about 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, and I listened to it once when I got it, clean it, listened to it, kind of stuff. But like the Joe Perry Project, it didn't get a real strong listen. I just put it on, listened to it, working on other stuff. Usually when I get home, I got about 30 things to do on the computer before I even get to thinking. So anyway, moving on to the next track, Hold On. So now they've changed it up for me. They're not doing that 70s rock anymore. Now they've gone straight on into 60s psychedelia rock as played by 70s rockers. So they don't really know how to do it, but they're trying for it. There's a really great wah-wah riff, really great wah-wah solo in this one. And the best part about this song, it doesn't sound anything like Aerosmith. Which you had two in a row that sounded like Aerosmith tunes.
True, yeah. This is a really weird one for me. I really like the solo. I think it might be a talk box, but whatever it is, it's great.
Talk box, why? I mean, if you're doing it the same.
That type of thing, yeah. And there's this great main riff, this kind of jang, jang, jang. I mean, I can remember it now, and I've listened to it once. It goes jang, 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 jing, 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 something like that. And it's cool, really dramatic, and I don't know, just great, it just works. A bit Lynyrd Skynyrd-esque still, but like Lynyrd Skynyrd doing something like Simple Man with all that emotion, but sped up. But then suddenly they go reggae and they've got this ding, 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 and it starts going ding, 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 what? And yeah, this is really strange for me. And it all starts to go a bit odd. And then you hear the singing about equality. And they're singing like, listen to what the people should be saying, stand up for equality. Or I'm paraphrasing, that's not quite it. But it's suddenly like this kind of reggae protest song, but done really ham-fistedly and weird in the middle of a hard rock track.
So it's like that Poison tune when they're like singing about social change, except they won't take a stand.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And then it kind of recovers itself, but it's all a bit strange. And then there's a bit where they bring in some steel pans, kind of going...
If there's anything a song with a talk box and wah-wah pedals needs, steel drums.
So I think they were trying to do something different. They were getting experimental, but when... I don't know. There seems to be a phenomenon of bands getting experimental by going inappropriately into reggae and then starting to sing about freedom and rights in a really ham-fisted way. And they've definitely done that. So, but I love the riff and I love the solo. So, I don't know. Go on.
Have you ever thought to yourself while we're doing this, why are we doing this? We're finding things that we don't want to find. Hold On is a great example. Yeah, that's left. But that particular song, probably best left alone.
Yes, I agree.
Put that in there with the Raider, with the Ark or the Covenant, and walk away.
Indeed. But yeah, okay. So let's move on from that odd one. So track 4, Sharpshooter. So it's got a fast drum intro, and it comes in with some big guitar chords. I would call this dramatic 80s rock. I think they were realizing at this point that it's 1980 or 81 when they're recording it, and they're saying, what's going on at this time? Okay, let's try and do a bit of this. The vocals for me are totally different here. They're a bit over the top. It's trying to be, I would say, dramatic and in an 80s kind of Europe sort of way. It doesn't quite work.
We're not at Europe yet, are we?
All right, maybe not quite, but it's going towards that type of thing.
Okay, it's definitely headed down the same path. It's in the same neighborhood.
Yeah. And then there's a catchy chorus. It's kind of standard. The solo is quite nice. You've got some flanger and some nice bluesy licks. I like the dynamics at the end, like what you said earlier, which I definitely agree with, that they really play their hearts out, even though the material is not that brilliant. They're really pushing it and they're building, and the drums are cranking up a gear, then another gear, then another gear, and it really kind of lets rip at the end with this huge buildup. And that's quite nice. So I would say the performance, in terms of the band and the dynamics, brings what is a fairly mediocre standard attempt at 80s pop rock out of being terrible. It makes it actually quite listenable and pretty decent.
Yeah, the best thing on this album so far has been the performances, not the material.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because they're really going for this. They're going hard, and you know, there's probably high fives after every take going, you did it, buddy, you did it. And they did do it, to be clear. So, you know, it starts off with like, you know, that big intro you're talking about. It's like, oh, are we going to rock? Are we really going to do this now? No. This is the first time they started this intro. And this is a recurring theme from this point on. Why they put all of these songs in a row like this, I don't know, but they did it. Where the intro comes in and you're like, yeah, and then they go, nope. And it's only like 15 seconds. You get 15 seconds of this amazing nope. And then every time, we're just kidding. We're not doing that. Mm-hmm. That became very irritating for me, because a lot of these intros, the material was far stronger than what they ended up playing later. You know, there's a lot of three chord, catchy,
yep,
hook laden, three chord progressions. You know, if they did any chords other than power chords and an E bar chord, I don't know what it was. Don't think they did. But, you know, it starts off in the vocals. I love the vocals on this one. It's much better because it sounds different. You know, he's going for that throaty, that smoky, you know, that kind of, yeah, everybody's feeling it kind of thing, which about
being. That was a very good Tom Waits impression there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I tried. I do my best. But then, you know, he's doing like this emotive, he's feeling it. About a sharpshooter? What the hell? Come on. So you're singing, you're doing this emotional singing about nothing.
Yep.
That makes it a little bit difficult. I mean, if you had done that vocal delivery on I Need Love, you'd have a lot better. You know, if you'd swapped those, you'd have a lot better songs. Because, I mean, I love Aerosmith. Don't get me wrong. Again, not the biggest fan in the world, but I mean, I got everything. I've got, you know, 20 years of their work on vinyl. So I think that qualifies me. They didn't sing about a goddamn thing. And they never, it wasn't until later on that they tried to sing about things. And when they tried to sing about things, that's when Steven Tyler got emotive and serious. Whole rest of the time, he's just, you know, making monkey noises and, you know, dancing like a weirdo, wearing satin shirts, like satin leotards backwards. And so now this would have been perfect for your Steven Tyler voice. You would have nailed it. Anyway, you didn't do that though. You tried to be serious about sharpshooting. Okay. Maybe he's talking about professional wrestling and the sharpshooter, the Bret Hart, the Hitman Hart finishing move. Oh no, that's too early for that. He was still in Canada. Anyway, you talked about the solo, so I'm gonna talk about the solo. This is an amazing guitar solo. This is masterful. This is a master class on how to play a guitar solo without doing hammer-ons or pull-offs, you know, no fretboard tapping, no crazy amount of effects to make you sound great. He's not whipping the echo or the delay. He's just playing a beautiful melody full of attitude, and it's great. And the lyrics are, it's not great.
I agree. Yeah.
All right. So now we will start the ultimate track of side one.
So this is Every Morning, and this is you, isn't it?
It is me. And it starts off with like, oh my God, is this, should I stay or should I go?
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it. But it starts off with like, oh my God, this is now, should I stay or should I go? And so they did the reggae earlier, and now they're doing the English version, the punk English version of reggae.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I really would love to have been around the table, you know, while they're trying to write this. You know, they got all their cigarettes on the table, put out probably like on the tablecloth, drunk, and Heineken bottles strewn about. Oh God, what about the Clash? They did a song. We could steal that. I just can't imagine what it's like. And you know, again,
I don't know if this was before. I think this was before that song, you know.
Oh.
I'm going to check. I think that was like 82 or 83. Probably 82. I'm just going to have a look now.
The Slash's first record was 77, wasn't it? Or Clack, not the Slash.
The Clack. Yeah, it was. Oh, yeah, look, it was 81. Was that track? Oh, yeah. It was released as a single in May 82.
This came out
in written in 81, but not released till 82. So, no, this album we're doing was before Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Oh. I'm Googling this because I want to know. Oh, it's off Combat Rock.
Yeah.
I have that. When did the album come out? 82.
Exactly.
Well, apparently I screwed that up. So regardless, it still sounds like Should I Stay or Should I Go? One is a popular song, one is not. And then we've got this another track about living your dreams and finding your life and then it's like, I love you. And I don't really know what they got going on here. Singing is great, though. Great vocal performance by St. Holmes.
Yeah. So, no, yeah, you're right. You've got that kind of syncopated riff that is a bit reminiscent of Should I Stay or Should I Go? I kind of liked it. And it kicks in. I would describe this as 80s feel-good rock. It's melodic. It's poppy and it's got a bit of a simple riff. And then I listened to it a bit more and I thought, you know what? This is a bit like power pop. It's like a fast power pop ballad. And I think this couldn't have been done pre-punk, really. I think this is where they have been listening a bit to what's going on at the time. I really do like the solo, and I'm going to get a bit technical here. So this does what I would call a Sweet Home Alabama, which is where the solo is in a different key to the actual song, but it's in a related key. So in Sweet Home Alabama, the song's in D, but the solo's in G.
Relative minor.
The chord sequence works in both. No, it's not relative minor.
I know. That's the only harmony I know.
But it just works. It's slightly odd, and you hear it, and you go, "That's not kind of what I expected." But then it's different, and it works. This is the same. He's playing in the dominant key. So let's say it's in the key of A, but it has the chord of E in it. He's playing in the key of E. So it's so related that it's not out of tune or anything, but it just doesn't do what you'd expect, and I like that. And then there's a bit of piano that comes in at the end. I like that. And again, they do a big dynamic build where they're really playing their souls out over this song. And it isn't anything new. It's not the best thing I've ever heard, but I just kind of liked this. I thought they went for the 80s and actually managed to sort of get it right.
The one thing I'll say about this album so far is that we haven't heard anything that if I were a record buyer in 1981 to make me go, yeah, here's my $5.
Yeah, there's a few moments like the one I've just talked about, but yes, this is not the sound of 1981, let's put it that way. This is the sound of 1975 with a few bits of 1981 thrown in there.
Right, it's just, I mean, they're playing their hearts out. They're trying. The material just so far, it's just not there.
Yeah, no. So, okay. So number six, which I guess is track one of side two. Mm-hmm. And they're doing that thing where they've sequenced this very much for vinyl. Of course,
it was 1981.
Vinyl was the only format. But what I mean by that is they've sequenced it as though you might just start by playing either side. Like, people might just skip over to side B, having only listened to track one of side A. So let's make this first track of side B like an album opener. So it's got this car driving sample at the start, and it kicks in with these fast rock riffs with some screaming and soloing. It's very much a hoisting of the flag, a showing of the artillery type of song, a statement of intent, I guess, is the sort of phrase I'm looking for. And then you've got this bluesy wailing vocals coming in again. I think we're back to Steven Tyler mode. But then the chorus changes it up a bit. It goes melodic. I would say it goes a bit power pop, or even a bit punk, ever so slightly, because it's energetic, it's snappy, it's rough, it's fast, and it's melodic, and I actually really like it. And it's got this great ending with these big stabby riffs. And actually, I think this one track, aside from the vocals, which are incredibly 1973, actually, if you took that music and you had a more new wavy type singer on top, that could have been the sound of 1981. And I think it's cool.
One of the things I love about people that love punk rock is they hear punk rock everywhere. I was recently involved in a discussion where, was Kiss punk rock?
No is the answer.
Of course it's the, of course no is the answer. Kiss is completely antithetical to everything punk rock ever stood for.
Yeah.
Not the point. So is Whitford St. Holmes, I'm just going to say. Moving on. But yes, you're absolutely right. It goes straight into Aerosmith again. So now we're doing another Aerosmith song. And it seems like about half of the tracks are Aerosmith songs and half of the tracks are Derek St. Holmes tunes. And, you know, when I think back to the songs that he sang, like Stranglehold and stuff like that, it doesn't sound anything like what we're listening to here. So
I think we need to check those credits. You know, I wonder if one wrote some and the other wrote some of the others. That would make
really
some sense.
Okay, I'll,
or if they just credited
after
everyone.
I finish this song, I'll pause it. I'll pause the recording and I'll go grab the record.
And we'll cool,
see
man.
If it says anything. I don't think it does though. Okay. There was no insert. There was just a white paper.
It might on the back though, or even on sometimes on the actual record label.
I'll grab. Okay, look, I'll grab it right now.
Cool.
Come on, making me get up. Well, I got it. Okay, I got it. So here it is. Look at that cover. Describe this cover. Describe what you see.
Oh, yeah. This album cover is two men with long hair standing next to each other. One wearing a suit, a white suit. The other
minus a tie.
Yeah. The other wearing a short sleeve T-shirt. They look very 70s.
No, that's a sleeveless T-shirt. That was American chic at this time.
Yeah, sleeveless
T-shirt. It's probably a belly shirt, too.
Yeah. So, and it says Whitford St. Holmes in a big square. It's a pretty, it's like a bad 70s album cover.
Oh, and that's military stencil.
Oh, yeah, good point.
American military stencil. On the back of this album, there are no credits of any sort.
Wow. What about on the actual label of the physical vinyl?
Oh, here we go. The label's got it.
Here we go. All right.
All right. This is weird.
Okay.
The first two tracks, which we determined to be complete Aerosmith tracks,
yeah,
were written by St. Holmes. And then Hold On was written by Whitford.
Oh, wow. The one that's nothing like anything. Okay.
Right. And then Sharpshooter, which is a little bit like Aerosmith as well.
Yeah.
Was written by St. Holmes.
Okay.
And then Every Morning was also written by St. Holmes.
Okay.
So, and I will announce as we do, Action is where we started, written by St. Holmes. Also, another Aerosmith tune.
So they're almost all written by St. Holmes so far. Mm. Well, not almost all, but more than half.
Okay, I'll just tell you, Brad Whitford only wrote one song on side two, which was Spanish Boy.
Right.
Interesting. I'm going to set that down because just Spanish
Boy. Okay, right. So, what are we actually doing?
I didn't do my thing about Action yet.
No, exactly.
So, yeah, well, I already said it. Back to Aerosmith. And you saw this song as a statement of intent. And I saw this song as a lack of a statement about who they are. I'm still waiting for this band to tell me who they are, what they stand for musically speaking. I don't give two craps about your politics or your beliefs, whatever, because you guys are just really drunk and stoned and whatever. You don't know shit. But I'm waiting for them to show me a style, to show me a chemistry, to show me something. And nothing. I mean, we're getting some really good solos out of Whitford, another great guitar solo. And Whitford, for me, has been the star of this record so far because I loved his solo. I've loved every solo he's done. And each of these songs so far has been almost great, never quite there. And they fall flat a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, moving on to the one single from the record, Shy Away.
Indeed.
And I don't have a whole lot to say on this one, so I'll just say what I got and I'll move on. But it starts off with another great intro riff, takes it away. And then they really don't know what they're doing for the rest of the song. It's another song that's just like, okay, you got the pieces, but you're not making them dance.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to say about this one. I think it's fine. It sounds a bit power popish again. It's melodic, punchy. There's some good simple riffs, catchy pop rock chorus. Yeah, do you know what? It's fine. I think I quite liked it, but I didn't have that much to say. It was maybe a bit.
You know what the problem with this is, though? This is the single.
Well, yes, exactly.
And we both go, well, there's not much to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, very true. Yes. Yeah, no, that's right. Okay, well, next is Does It Really Matter? Yeah, well, this is like dark, steady to fast rock. Somehow the vocals feel really unconvincing on this. It's like he's trying a different style and it's not working. The chorus is catchy. I quite like the harmony backing vocals. And the solo is quite good. But Does It Really Matter is the name of the song. And the answer is no, it doesn't.
You know, for me, it starts off with a nice little dirty intro. And then the whole song changes again. And that intro, it's like this slinky, wonderful, kind of dirty 70s, late 70s rock. And then they go, nah, we're not doing that anymore. Let's move on into 80s pop rock. We're happy now. In the end, it turns out to be a cute little pop song. But does it really matter? Does this song work? No, it doesn't. It's a song that just doesn't matter. If you cut it, it would have been fine.
Absolutely.
And that's,
I agree.
Which is a running theme on the, this is a, it's a recurring theme or a running joke, however you want to look at it, on this record is, you know, there's not one song here so far, foreshadowing maybe, that I heard where I'd go, man, if that wasn't there, this album would suck. Haven't heard that yet.
I agree.
Then we move into Spanish Boy, which, I mean, does that remind anybody of Manish Boy, or is it just...
Yeah, I definitely thought that. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
You know, it, again, it's got a great, cool start, and I'm thinking, oh my God, stick with this. And no, they didn't. They didn't do that. They're like, no, we're going to do this other thing that's different from that first thing. And you know, it's and then the song is building and you've got this great rising action and it comes to a climax and then the guitar solo comes in and you just know it's going to be great, and it's not. And it's not. Yeah. He plays an amazing solo that's wrong, because that solo should, he did it backwards. He did a building solo. He should have done a falling solo. When that break started, he should have been at about 47,000 miles an hour, blowing the stuff up, punching the back of the guitar, going punk rock, doing everything. And instead, he starts off with the building solo that we've heard 1,000 times. If he had flipped it over, this song would have been great.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying, man. Yeah, for me, it was an interesting start. Ambient effects and machine gun sounds. Then you get these steady driving drums and this driving doom, 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 doom bass. And then a big, nice 80s rock riff. I can't, one of those sleazy, groovy, hair-rocky Motley Crue riffs. But then, like you say, yeah, it kicks in.
Pre-Motley Crue even.
Yeah, exactly. But then it kicks in and it's just standard blues rock vocals. It's fine, but it's nothing new. The chorus is all right, but this is really trite. This is just overdone, and it's not good enough for you to accept that. Because if so, you know, like AC/DC can get away with just doing the same thing, you know, because they do it great, but this isn't good enough for that, really. No. So, okay, so that's that. And then the final track then is Mystery Girl. So it starts with a nice bluesy guitar riff, then this big blast on the drums and a big chord, and then it repeats that a few times. And I think that's interesting. It's something a bit different. It hasn't kicked in with a full beat. Then it finally does. It kicks in with this fast rock and roll thing. It's a nice riff. And it's a bit unusual. The chord sequence is odd, basically. It's just not what you would normally do for this sort of music, and I think that's good. And it almost sounds a bit like Wasp because of the chord sequence to me and the guitar tone. I find it interesting. I like what's happening with the drums. There's a great section where they go, they use the cowbell, and it just really works. And at that point, you just feel like, yes, all I have been waiting for is some cowbell. And now it's here. I never knew I even wanted it. Yeah, I think it's a good, strong song. It's nice and succinct. And then it's finished after whatever it is, 3.5 minutes. And it's great. And if there was more like that on the record, I think it would be a very cool record. Or a cooler record than it is. So I kind of like that one, but that's me.
Okay. Well, we're allowed to disagree. And for me, you know, the intro is really cool again, and then back to the other thing, which I really hate that. The intro of a tune should introduce me to the song, not slap me in the face and go, just kidding. Over, I mean, once or twice is one thing, but like 8 in a row is, so it's irritating. But you know, it's an up tempo song. Nice to end the record that way. But the song is so bland for me. It's so boring. And you know what? Maybe I was just beaten into submission at this point. Really, really giving this the go the once over, and just hearing the same tropes. hearing the same vibes, and it's just like, ugh. Can you just play a song? Can you just play me? Could you play Wild? Could they do Wild Thing? Could they just play Wild Thing start to finish on this album? Probably not. They'd start off with, you know, and then they'd just go, and then into reggae or something ridiculous. And that's the problem I have with this record, if you don't mind me just, you know, moving into the sum up.
Yeah.
There is a lot of great performance here. Every song is performed like a badass, and they put all of their heart and soul into it. Unfortunately, the material, as we have said a couple of times, perhaps you noticed, the material is a little bit lacking. The songwriting is a little bit lacking. Had they brought in a professional co-writer, this album probably would have been truly amazing and worthy of never having been forgotten.
And yeah.
Whereas these two guys who aren't, oh crap. Sorry, I just broke something. These two guys who really aren't writers wrote an album and it just didn't come out great. And it's unfortunate, but it is what it is. I can't make it better.
Yeah.
So, and you know, in my case, Spinator Bennett, I mean, I only paid $8, so I'm okay with that. But yeah, definitely put it in the bin.
Yeah, okay, look, for me, I'm right on the fence, and I know I have to decide, but basically, I almost wanted there to be some more ridiculously terrible moments so I could definitely, securely, decisively say, this is in the bin. There weren't, apart from that, whatever it is, track, I think it's called Hold On, where it goes reggae and a bit odd, yeah, track three. Apart from that, there's no ridiculous terrible moments. It's correct. All fine. There's some quite good moments, but there's nothing great apart from possibly some of the solos. But even then, I don't think any of them are essential.
Yeah.
So, like, the thing is, I'm probably never going to listen to it again. It's not because it's terrible. It's just because there is so much music like this, and there is so much music that is better than this, even if it's only a bit better than this.
That's how we.
Yeah, I'm getting there. So, okay, so look, I guess I am going to say bin it. It's one of those where if none of the stuff had happened before that had influenced this, then you'd say this is good, you know. If they were doing this for the first time, then I would totally accept the fact that it's not the best thing in the world. But yeah, everything that's good on it really has already been done a lot and has already been done better. So there's not really any point in this thing. So therefore, yeah, fine. I'm going to bin it too.
I don't hate it. I don't love it. If I didn't own it, I would never listen to it again.
Sure.
And I bought it before I listened to it, which, you know, maybe not always the smartest play, but again, I would rather spend the money to do these episodes, listening to them on vinyl, than I would listening to them on YouTube. Because mm-hmm. I feel like I take better notes, I get better information, and I'm more eloquent, and I've got more to say. So, you know, I spent the money for the listeners.
There you go.
That's, and if I get an email right or a text message or a direct message saying, I'll take that off your hands, maybe it happens. So...
there you go. $200. Yeah.
$200.
No, nothing else. No, that's it. That's it. Well, thank you for listening.
Thanks, everybody. Catch you next week. Bye.
Bye.